Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
He talks about PAYGO. I tell you what PAYGO means when you're a senator from Massachusetts. When you're a colleague of Ted Kennedy, PAYGO means you pay and he goes ahead and spends.
Being lectured by the president on fiscal responsibility is a little bit like Tony Soprano talking to me about law and order.
Bush and Kerry trading zingers over the deficit in last night's debate. And if the overnight polls mean anything, John Kerry has won all three debates. As I mentioned before the news, the CNN and CBS polls each have Kerry winning last night by about 15 points. The ABC poll has it a tie, but also has many more Republicans than Democrats in its sample and many more than in the other polls. Kerry also improved his likability by 15 points more than the president improved his in the CNN Gallup poll. And if this holds over time, it would make George Bush the first incumbent president to lose all three debates since the last George Bush. We'll play a few more clips from the debate, but we'll also talk now about what this whole series of debate means. With probably the most well-prepared journalist in America going into these debates, James Fallows, Atlantic Monthly national editor, had boned up by watching years of Bush and Kerry's debates from previous campaigns and wrote about them in the July issue. Hi, James. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on again.
You started the Atlantic piece by noting neither Bush nor Kerry had previously ever lost a debate. Well, someone had to lose this time. What do you think happened?
Well, I think I posted a little item on the Atlantic's website after that first debate because that was by an almost inconceivable margin the worst George Bush has ever done in his debates in the past. So clearly he lost that first one, and he's returned more to his normal style in these other two. And the strange thing about winning and losing these debates, except for the first one, I think, is that Bush and Kerry have been playing different games and doing to different things, aiming towards different goals. The question is how close or how much distance each of them traveled towards the goal he was trying to attain. And that's we're not going to know until Election Day.
How much importance should we attach to these overnight network polls?
They have proven to be fairly fluid in the past. But the way they've shown fluidity is that in the past two presidential debates this time, Senator Kerry has seemed to do better as time has gone on. So the fact that he's being seen as a clear winner right away means the Bush campaign will be pretty soon saying, well, we never said our guy was a fancy talker, and we're talking about a man who can lead America, not somebody who can stand up with a fancy pants debater.
It's a little late to be downplaying expectations.
In all of George Bush's past career starting in Texas, he had very, very aggressively played the expectations game, that he couldn't expect him to kind of trade this verbal badinage with people who specialized in it. It's harder to do that when you're the incumbent. I think they were starting to do it again before this third debate after his difficulties, especially in the first one.
You know, you talk about their different games going in, and here's what I think the main story of these four debates has been. Tell me your opinion. They all happen in the context of deep dissatisfaction with President Bush on both the economy and the war in Iraq, certainly among those identified as swing voters. And people were tuning in to see if John Kerry is a viable alternative. And compared to the caricature of Kerry that these people who are not politics junkies, who were not paying the close attention that you and I might have been earlier in the year, compared to the caricature of Kerry that they saw in the attack ads all summer, you know, the guy who threw away his medals and lied about his Purple Hearts and would make the terrorists hit us again and give away the store to France, which was all they knew, he didn't look that scary. Any thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that is a fundamental point, and it's the way in which these debates resembled those in 1980 between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Again, many people may not remember them. I remember with painful clarity because I'd been working for Carter before that. You know, Reagan had been seen before the debates as this lightweight, extremist, inexperienced movie actor, and he presented himself in the debates as being a plausible other candidate. And I think that for the reason you've just said and a couple of others, the debates have been of profound importance in this campaign and a profound advantage for Kerry. They don't guarantee that he will win, but they did help him sort of pass that plausibility standard, especially by looking so much more presidential than the president in the first one, which was the one most people saw. And because he was able over these three debates to stand there with the president, to be, you know, by implication, the equal of the most powerful man in the world, of standing up there. And what Bush has done Bush has not been able to address anything of that. He's been what he's been left to do is essentially to rally his base, and we saw that very clearly last night.
You know, it's interesting to me, James, and my guest is James Fallows, Atlantic Monthly national editor, and I heard Doris Kearns Goodwin talking about this too on IMUS this morning. The professional political class, meaning journalists and politicians and other people in the business, rated all three of these debates more for Bush, or at least closer for Bush, than ordinary Americans did. Regular folks are giving Kerry these double-digit wins. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a similar split between elite and popular opinion?
I have noticed that, and I think that one reason for that is, you know, I find myself going through this too. You know, I have a background I once worked 25 years ago in the Democratic Party. Most of what I've been writing in the Atlantic in the last couple of years has been about the disaster of Bush administration foreign policy. So I go into this thinking that the president does not deserve reelection. However, I'm interested to see how he makes his case, how he advances his cause, how he does, how he parries what the senator is doing. So my sort of ice skating judge view of this is that he's done surprisingly well at the task he set for himself. Now, by another standard, which if I were an undecided voter, I was saying, how is he addressing my concerns about my lost job or the minimum wage or showing any sign of error in thinking about Iraq, then I would be more likely to think that he was not addressing those concerns. So it may be a difference between the sort of technical and tactical judgment of the professional class and the how does this affect my life judgment of the electorate.
That's right. That's very similar to what I think, and with apologies to the late Jacques Derrida.
Hi.
Here is how...
Hello.
Deb, another one.
Here is how I deconstruct the journalist deconstruction. We are so busy saying that what matters is posture and reaction shots and who gets off the sharpest zingers. Cokie Roberts the other week said you could watch the debate with the sound off and know who won, which I completely disagree with and even find insulting. And I think the average American last night listened to their answers on jobs and health care and decided that Bush has helped to create this mess and Kerry has better solutions. And I know it's a radical concept today to suggest that content matters, policy matters, but I think that's largely what happened and is responsible for the disconnect. What do you think?
Well, I think that could well be. And in defense for a moment of Cokie Roberts, with whom I've had many disagreements over the years, historically, the matter of body language and posture has seemed to matter. I mean, that has, for example, in John Kennedy taking on Richard Nixon in 1960, it seemed to matter that Kennedy looked at least, you know, the equal of Nixon. And similarly with Ronald Reagan, both against Carter and against Walter Mondale. So it's not a ridiculous concept to say that people, that's part of the calculation people have in choosing their national leader. But I do think that especially in the states where this election is now playing out, especially in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where the job loss is much greater than the rest of the country, and in Michigan and in Wisconsin and Florida with its own different things, that people are now looking for what is the policy that will get us out of Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
What is the policy that will do something about education and employment? So I agree with you on that front.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who thinks that policy matters. So let me play a clip of another exchange that I think goes to this and that I think may have been key last night. This is about 20 seconds or so of Kerry then Bush on jobs and the minimum wage.
The minimum wage is the lowest minimum wage value it has been in our nation in 50 years. If we raise the minimum wage, which I will do over several years to $7 an hour, 9.2 million women who are trying to raise their families would earn another $3,800 a year.
But let me talk about what's really important for the worker you're referring to. And that's to make sure the education system works. It's to make sure we raise standards. Listen, the No Child Left Behind Act is really a jobs act when you think about it.
Now, James Fallows, I thought that might have been a key last night, that Bush kept coming back to the idea that No Child Left Behind is a jobs program, which if you're a 35-year-old unemployed person in Toledo, sounds like it comes from Mars, because you're not going back to take your fourth grade standardized test. So how is this going to help you find work? What do you think?
I agree. I thought that was the president's absolute low moment last night on any kind of logical or policy grounds, because Senator Kerry had a quite detailed answer about the minimum wage and was saying, you know, there's none of this flip-flop he'd been accused of. Yes, he was for it. Yes, this was how much it would be. Yes, this is how much money would add to the pockets. And he, again, specified female workers because that's seen as part of the target group now. And the president didn't even deign to address any of that, didn't even say, well, this is going to cripple small business. And so that I think his constant reference to the controversial No Child Left Behind Act as the answer to every jobs problem, I think will not help him in Ohio in particular.
I know you're good at fact-checking. I saw you do it on CBS after the second debate, and I thought you did a really good, detailed job. I made some notes of things to ask you about, but first I'm curious what jumped out at you if you were watching the debate this way last night that was either just egregiously wrong or misleading or otherwise deserving of a fact-check.
Well, I think the Republicans, the two big embarrassing errors so far in the debate have been made by Dick Cheney and in his I never met Senator Edwards line, which was immediately disproved, and George Bush last night saying, oh, I never said I wasn't worried about Osama bin Laden.
Yes, and then all the networks had the tape last
exactly.
night of him saying, I'm not worried about Osama bin
right.
Laden.
Right, and so that's there's nothing... You know, here's my meta theory here. Something that goes on in these debates historically is if there's a concern people have about a certain candidate, these unintentional revelations the candidate makes, they matter if they match some pre-existing concern. The pre-existing concerns about John Kerry were too long-winded, too indecisive, too arrogant and elitist, et cetera. There's almost nothing he did that matched those concerns. The concerns about President Bush, you know, too inflexible, too out of touch with the facts, too arrogant or haughty, many things he did fit those pre-existing concerns, including this business of, you know, hey, I never said that about Osama bin Laden. So I think he hurt himself by some of these demonstrable errors.
Interesting. Let me throw a quick Bush one and a quick Kerry one at you. Bush said Kerry voted 98 times for tax hikes and opposes the Bush tax cuts for the middle class, like ending the marriage penalty and increasing dependent child deduction. True?
I think as a technical matter, since Kerry... first, I don't know for sure. My guess is that the 98 is greatly inflated by including all the process votes. You know, every bill when it goes through has, you know, up to a dozen or 15 process votes. So you could have what were two or three or four real decisions inflated into 98 votes.
Right, because all those lines. And on immigration, Kerry said the borders are less protected today than before 9/11, and 4,000 people a day come across illegally from Mexico. True?
I believe that to be true, and then Bush added to it by saying that they're better protected than they were when he was governor of Texas, which I think wasn't quite the way he meant to stress it. But I think, you know, the general reports are that there's been no significant increase, especially in southern border protection. The legal visa process is, of course, much more cumbersome than it used to be, and there's many fewer foreign students, but the illegal entry process seems to be very little improved.
And it was interesting that Bob Schieffer said he got more mail before the debate on immigration than any other issue. Did you notice that?
I did. That was very interesting, and something I'm sure you have seen, that there are issues which the sort of political class can let slip until they notice how serious they are for, you know, the average person.
Right. Well, thank goodness for email and the internet and blogs to keep us honest, right? James Fallows, national editor for the Atlantic Monthly, his fabulous article in the July issue looked at Bush and Kerry debates from the past. We'll continue with James Fallows and continue to talk about the Bush and Kerry debate last night and where the campaign goes from here. The debates are done, but 2.5 weeks to go. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
We allow you, if you choose to, you don't have to, but we give you broader competition to allow you to buy into the same health care plan that senators and congressmen give themselves. If it's good enough for us, it's good enough for every American. I believe that your health care is just as important as any politician in Washington, D.C.
We have a fundamental difference of opinion. I think government-run health will lead to poor quality health, will lead to rationing, will lead to less choice. Once a health care program ends up in a line item in the federal government budget, it leads to more controls.
We're debriefing the debate season, and those clips, of course, from last night on healthcare policy with James Fallows, national editor of the Atlantic Monthly, who had watched hours and hours of Bush and Kerry's previous debates to prepare for analyzing these, and his excellent article on that was in the July Atlantic Monthly. By the way, I want to give a shout-out to the people who run the telephone bar at 2nd Avenue and 9th Street. I was down there with our crew last night to watch the debate, and they had me in my own pathetic little version of heaven. They have the debate on one TV screen with its sound turned way up, and the Yankee Red Sox game on the other screen with the sound off. It was just perfect for me, anyway. And it was really interesting that the telephone bar was packed, but everyone was really there to watch the debate. If the chatter ever got too loud, people started going, shh, and the talkers quieted right down. And James Fallows, this was happening in lots of places last night, and I don't think we've ever seen politics as mass pop culture like this before, you think?
Now, it's been quite a while since I've seen this kind of interest in a presidential debate. And I should say, during the break, I've been looking at your blog and studying the picture of Bush with the coat. Do you want to talk about that?
Okay, what do you think it is?
I think that it's... I guess I don't think he was having a walkie-talkie on there. And my argument would, I have a sort of forensic argument and a political argument. The forensic argument is I've seen a number of these photos, and the shape of the apparent bulge changes enough that you think, you know, that it must be something strange with the photo. The political argument is, you know, that was the first debate we're talking about when he had, oh no, sorry, it's the second debate.
Second one too. I didn't notice it last night. I don't know if other people did.
I didn't see it, but the one where it was most prominent was the first debate where he did most abysmally poorly. So if he was getting coaching from that in the first debate, then...
Fire the coach.
Yeah, he would have to, maybe his daughter Jenna or something was coaching him.
But do you have an alternative hypothesis?
Well, the tailor, Henry de Paris, or whatever his name is, the guy who's the tailor to all the presidents, was quoted recently in the Washington Post and saying that he was sure it was just the bunching of a shirt under tension.
Huh.
So who knows?
You know what's interesting to me, James? It turns out that just about everything we were supposed to think about these debates going into them was wrong. We thought the formal podium debates would favor Bush and the town hall format would favor Kerry. Wrong. We thought foreign affairs topics would favor Bush and domestic issues would favor Kerry. Mostly wrong. We thought the short answer requirements in the red light, green light system would help Bush and hurt Kerry. Wrong. And we thought the debates would be so sterilized by all the rules that they couldn't convey real meaning. Dead wrong, I think. Do you agree?
Well, in most points, yes. And I think that one of the things that's been one of the reasons debates have mattered over the years is there's always been something unexpected to them. You know, it's live TV, it's live combat, it's live competition, and something always happens nobody foresaw. And I think the big surprise to us as viewers, but I gather to the Kerry team, was a deliberate thing, was this time clock. You know, they were putting out a lot of stuff before the debates about how, the senator was going to be constrained by this visual time clock, and it wasn't going to be embarrassing when he talked over it. And in fact, that was a godsend to him. It made his own answers much, much crisper. And you saw each time how he ended right on the red light. And several times in the debates, the president seemed to be trying to talk out the clock. And so trying to wait for the clock to turn colors. And that in a subliminal way, I think, was a problem for him.
Right. Made him look less than substantive. Bush did spend much of the night, as was anticipated, calling Kerry a Massachusetts liberal. Do you think that resonates in 2004 the way it did when Bush Sr. called Dukakis a Massachusetts liberal all fall in 88?
I think it makes sense only if you assume that the strategy for Bush in this debate is not even to bother, you know, rebutting Kerry's criticism on the merits. As you were mentioning earlier with the minimum wage, you know, he didn't even get into it, but rather to reassure and re-energize his own base and to have the target of this debate be people who would vote for him if they voted but might not vote. And so while to somebody who's, again, lost his job in Ohio, calling Kerry a liberal may not matter that much, to somebody in Utah who's wondering whether to get out to vote or somebody in rural Pennsylvania, it might have an energizing effect. So I think it was that much of a fine slicing and dicing of what will rally the base.
Although there is an alternative analysis to that, which is that, again, to go back to the Bush-Dukakis race in 88, that tagging of Dukakis as an out-of-touch liberal seemed to flip a lot of swing voters, so it could also be seen as an appeal to the center.
Yes, and it goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning, which is that the purpose of these debates at a time when there are obvious questions about national policy, you know, to say the combination of the economy and international relations slash Iraq, the question is the challenger an acceptable alternative? Is he a plausible alternative? And if the incumbent can define the challenger as being unacceptable, as being McGovern-like, as being on, as the president put it, the left bank of the mainstream,
right,
then that's a way of blunting that charge.
And Dukakis ran on a similar retort. You remember 88? He said the election was about competence,
yep,
not ideology. That was the phrase. And guess what? He lost. So why should it work any better for John Kerry?
Well, it should work better because the actual problems, you know, the problems are worse. The 1988, there were various sort of late second-term Reagan administration hangovers that that George Bush the first had to deal with, but he could say it's going to be a new administration with him, a kinder, gentler administration. There wasn't the kind of economic downturn we've had for the last 2 years, and there wasn't an ongoing war. So I think, and also, Dukakis was not prepared for this, and Kerry is somewhat better prepared for it, although he was slow to respond to the Swift boat ads.
I do want to open up the phones, get some listeners in here. Folks, here's the question. What do you think was important about the debate season now that it's over? If you want to single out a particular moment, if you want to pick up on a particular theme, you can be pundits here and do political analysis. You can ask James Fallows a question about things he said or written, whatever, here on this debate season now that it's over, or on airline 212-267-WNYC. We never ask you to pledge on the air, 212-267-9692, to debrief the debates. So, James, this fall miniseries of four debates is now over, and here we are with almost 3 weeks still before Election Day. Now what?
Well, I think we have, you know, day by day bitter campaigning, because I think the election is going to depend on 1,000 individual local circumstances, 1,000 get-out-the-vote efforts in different states, and, you know, nobody honestly knows how the election is going to turn out right now. But I think we can say that these debates have mattered a lot and that they've been a big plus for Senator Kerry. And so they've recast the whole election. You know, if you think back to 3 weeks ago before the debates, it looked like a very different dynamic from what we have now.
Let's take a phone call. Albin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yes. I just wanted to point out the big error that Kerry made last night when he had Bush gave him the perfect opening when they talked about a flu vaccine. If Bush protects the American people as he says he does, if he really is caring about the elderly, how could he outsource the vaccine production and then not monitor it? And then when we're in short supply, he says, just don't take, if you're not sick, don't take the vaccine, or if you're too young, don't take it. I think that's not leadership, and that's not really protecting the Americans.
In fact, I think we have a fact-check moment here with respect to the president on the flu vaccines. He referenced some British company. It's an American company, Chiron, that did outsource, you could call it, production of half the flu vaccine in America to a factory in Britain for some reason, James Fallows.
Right, and also I think that then the president said that the FDA or some American body closed down this, and in fact it was the British authorities,
yes,
that made the ruling. So he was, I agree with the caller, that was a place where Senator Kerry really could have, you know, stuck in the knife. Interestingly, in each debate, there have been half a dozen places like this where you think that Senator Kerry, who has this long experience as a prosecutor, could have said, you know, aha, Mr. President, here's the error of your ways. And I guess that shows, number one, sort of the difficulty of dealing under pressure, you know, even for somebody who's very accomplished at this, Senator Kerry is. Number two, I guess the strategic choice they made is, rather than seizing those moments, they would stick to their main message. And what the message Senator Kerry stuck to then was about, you know, he went into his health insurance riff. So
right.
I guess that was the decision they made ahead of time.
I guess it was a strategic decision, though you could see it as missed opportunities, you know, various missed opportunities along the way, including on health care. I mean, as Bush was calling Kerry a liberal, why didn't Kerry take the opportunity to call Bush a radical conservative and reframe the debate over whether Bush is too radically conservative for America,
right,
or to slam health savings accounts as a centerpiece of the Bush agenda on health care as something that's going to shift the burden of health insurance from your employer to you. I think that's a point to be hit out of the park, and Kerry never took it.
I agree. And also when Bush was saying that government-run health care is bad, you know, Kerry could have said, well, what about Medicare? I assume you're going to dismantle Medicare then. What about your own health care, Mr. President, run by the Navy, et cetera? So I guess it's I do have some sympathy for how hard it must be in real time to exploit every one of these opportunities as they come up.
Karen in Queens, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, everybody.
Hi.
I'm a Catholic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept listening to this going, John, why are you making this so hard? All he had to say was, the First Amendment says freedom of religion. It is my job as president to defend the First Amendment and everyone's religion. It is not my job to put my personal beliefs on your table and leave it alone. But no, he goes through this long discourse about this is an article of faith, and I don't want to impose this, and I've been an altar boy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, on the question about some of the bishops opposing him. Yeah, I don't know. You know, maybe he got to invoke God and his altar boy background for, or I don't know if he said altar boy, but, you know, I grew up a Catholic. He did say altar boy.
Yeah.
I grew up a Catholic. I am a Catholic, you know, and get those God points. He said God in a couple of answers, and at the same time defend the Constitution. James, what do you think?
I understand the logical appeal of what Culler is saying, and I think the senator could also say, well, you know, referring back to John Kennedy as he did before, you know, of saying that we, our fight has been to give people freedom of religion. But I know there was a strategic choice. They have found in their various researching and polling, and the post debate results seem to show it, that the more Senator Kerry can talk about these personal issues, actually the better it is for him. There is some, it seems to pay off in terms of, you know, quote, humanizing, unquote, him. So I think that's why he did it, as opposed to sticking to the more logically crisp formulation that you're suggesting.
Very good point. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Karen. We have a few minutes left with James Fallows, national editor for the Atlantic Monthly. Maybe you read his July article on the previous Bush and Kerry debates in different races. He watched hours and hours of them to prepare to analyze these debates. And Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think you got a good example of the weakness of a single moderator, because there was not one question that dealt with environmental issues or global warming. And I do believe in the first debate, the subject matter of the weapons of mass destruction, of weapons, WMDs, were never even raised.
Oh, I thought in the first debate, I don't know. James, do you think he's right on that point? I mean, they certainly debated Iraq and failure of policy there, as Kerry saw it.
And certainly Senator Kerry was pushing on some of the misleading intelligence about WMD. I think on the you have a point about the environment not being raised as an issue, and some other issues being raised a couple times in the domestic debate. I think that given the alternatives, the single moderator format is better than the other ones. In the old panel days, you could have just the studies of the transcripts. The panel ate up dramatically more time than the single moderator did, because they all were sort of competing with each other and posturing and getting their moments of airtime. And so in terms of getting the maximum info from the candidates, the single moderator format seems to be best, and then you can wonder, do the moderators choose the right question? But I think the format is the correct one.
Although one of the reasons we're doing our 30 issues in 30 days election series this year is that it did seem to us that there's so much focus on a few central issues this year, terrorism, Iraq, healthcare, jobs, that it's winding up excluding a lot of other important things. And in fact, next week we'll be doing a mini two-part series within the 30 issues, one on global warming and the other on other environmental issues. So, Bob, you might want to look forward to that next week. Srini in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful show.
Thank you so much.
One of the things, I watched all the three debates, and I'm watching it very closely from the time it started. I think as far as the health care is concerned, the president is totally out of touch. President signed the Medicare bill, and the Medicaid, which protects a lot of people with chronic care, including me, and especially in long-term care, is not funded by private insurance. It's funded by the government.
Right. So James Fallows, I was wondering about this too, and Srini, thank you. If this sticks to Americans, when Bush says, well, you know, when you put people on government plan, the government starts to dictate how you get your health care. People love their Medicare. people are probably relieved to know that more poor children would be put onto Medicaid under the Kerry plan. Does that, you know, government is going to run your life with respect to health care things stick in 2004?
Well, this is the, you know, the direct answer is I'm not sure how this plays out. The longer answer is this is one of the real knots of American politics to untie. It's what, you know, the Clinton administration was trying to do in 1993 of saying, look, we have this whole forest of private insurance schemes, and there are areas where having universal coverage and a sort of predictable plan like Medicare can give people less harassment and more coverage. So I think that for purposes of this election, the lines are more or less clear. Senator Kerry has placed tremendous stress on saying we have to expand the coverage and the government has to play some role. If he is elected, then the next debate will be how exactly he can do that. But I think for decision purposes now, people probably know which side, you know, which candidate has a more appealing overall approach from their point of view.
Sarah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with James Fellows.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I had sort of gone into this always planning on voting against Bush and was one of those people that was sort of a very strong anti-Bush vote. And I sort of realized that after watching these three debates that I am much more a pro-Kerry voter at this point, that I have really been won over by him. And he was just very commanding in all three of the debates, very steady. He always knew what was going on. He had the issues and the facts at his disposal. Bush just looked very bumbling. And it really sort of changed my perception of Kerry in a positive way, although I was always planning on voting for him.
But as an anti-Bush thing. And I think, James Fellows, it goes back to what we were talking about before, that Kerry got humanized to people who weren't paying much attention to him before this series of debates. In fact, let me play, you know, what I first thought was a silly question when Bob Schieffer asked it at the end of the debate last night, but wound up humanizing both Bush and Kerry, probably more to Kerry's advantage, this question about the strong women that they're all married to.
What is the most important thing you've learned from these strong women?
To listen to them. To stand up straight and not scowl.
Well, I guess the president and you and I are three examples of lucky people who married up.
Right.
And some would say maybe me more so than others.
James Fellows, did that matter?
I thought that actually was a very nice touch from Senator Kerry of showing that, and you could see him sort of doing that in real time and realizing that he should make the joke about it because he'd walked himself out on a limb, and I think that turned out to be successful. And I think what the caller was saying, I think, has been shown by the poll results that there's nothing Senator Kerry has revealed about himself that has sort of diminished personal support for him, and there's a lot that has increased support, both in his personal bearing, which especially in the first debate seemed more presidential, his command of a range of facts, and his ability to show various aspects of his personality other than just the fact machine. So I think that's one of the reasons I think the debates have been a big plus for the senator.
And to end, as we started, these overnight polls are showing 15-point margins of victory for Kerry, according to CNN and CBS, a tie in the ABC poll. But I think we can say that the debate season has been W for Kerry, and there are still 19 intense days to go in this campaign, so we'll see what happens post-debates. James Fellows, national editor for The Atlantic Monthly, great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.